and the Kinks, finishing up today's program from Something Else by the Kinks, Love Me Till the Sun Shines. That preceded by the great Italian band F.A.R. from Presto e Topi Verano a Cicarci, a track called Effie. For that, Jackie Gleason from a great double 7-inch called Music to Make You Misty. The track was called It All Depends on You. It was partially accompanied by Father of the Flood, a great track from a comp entitled Power Field 2. The track was called Animal Resource Facility. Flux Ion before that, from a compilation called Echo Chord Jubilee Comp, Echo Chord label comp, a song called Tides. And we open that set with Side 2, a great, great record, new record from Floris Van Hoof called Time Slime. Hey, that's everything we heard. My name is Scott. Been a pleasure. Hope it has for you. I'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, worldwide, WFMU.org. Stay tuned. Benjamin Walker is here.
one interpretation of our role in the universe, apart from, you know, loving each other, let's say, is to try to understand it, to be the part of the universe that can perceive the universe.
Michael Benson spends a lot of time perceiving the universe. He's authored two large coffee table books now, full of photographs of outer space. Most of the images he uses come from giant telescopes like Hubble, but not everything.
Some of the wide field shots I have weren't even taken using telescopes. They were simply time exposures taken with digital SLRs or even on film with wide angle lenses. You know, if you have a time exposure and a motor drive so that the camera turns along with the Earth, you can get fantastic wide field views of the Milky Way and so on. We are all beneficiaries of the greatest age of astronomy the world has ever known.
In Michael's latest book, Far Out, we see some of the most amazing objects in our universe from multiple perspectives. Some of these objects are closer to us than others, like the Cone Nebula, a mere 26,000 light years away.
Well, one of the things I love about the Cone Nebula is, you know, when you look at wide field views, you see this massive cloud of ionized hydrogen. So it looks like this fantastic, almost psychedelic lava lamp scene, you know. And then actually the lava lamp, you know, kitschy though it might sound, the lava lamp comparison is not too bad, because as you get closer in, the colors get more intense, and then you see that you have this strange, you know, cone shape. And then as you get all the way in, and you know, as you follow an image trail, astronomical image trail, to the tip of the Cone Nebula, you'll see stars emerging from the tip of the Cone Nebula. So it's all very, you know, it's kind of phallic and orgasmic.
It's the close-ups in Far Out that make Michael's book so much fun to curl up with. It's kind of like HD. The close-ups allow us to see celestial bodies like the Cone Nebula and the Whirlpool Galaxy in ways that not only force us to reassess our scientific understanding of the universe, but our poetic sense of who we are and where we live as well.
Apparently in the 19th century, a drawing of the Whirlpool, because we have to remember, photography in astronomy is relatively recent, and astronomers had to draw what they saw. Before that, a drawing of the Whirlpool by an astronomer named the Earl of Ross, William Parsons, the third Earl of Ross, made its way into a French astronomy book, and it's quite likely that in the late 1800s, a reproduction of his drawing was seen by Vincent van Gogh in his madhouse, actually, in his insane asylum. They had a library there. They got periodicals there. And he saw it, and it made its way into the center of the single most famous painterly depiction of the night sky, which is Van Gogh's Starry Night. If you look at that painting, you will see a depiction of the Whirlpool Galaxy. Just a classic, classic, beautiful spiral. What's going on frequently in a spiral, in fact, almost always, is you'll have very bright orange and reddish stars and star clusters defining the arms surrounded by gas and dust. And what's going on there is those are new stars being born. It's actually nebulae, lots of nebulae being born. And then on either side, you'll have darker areas, you know, that's the reason we see them as arms, because they're around, on either side, there are darker areas. And typically those are where stars that were born in the arms have been left. And they're typically, you know, and it's very hard to generalize with such vast amounts of space-time. Those contain stars like our sun. So, you know, our solar system also likely got left behind. It was formed in an arm, in a compression wave is what it is. It's the central part of the arm is where material is particularly compressed, and therefore solar systems are being born, stars are being born, and then they're left behind as the wave moves on.
It's hard not to flip directly to the back of the book to see the stuff that really is far out. Images of space and time at the edge of our perception. Many of these deep space images are time-lapse photographs taken by a fancy telescope on Mauna Kea in Hawaii.
In the end, you have an image that shows stars in our galaxy. It shows nearby galaxies, which are kind of bluish because they're in the relatively nearby universe. And then you see galaxy clusters, which are already turning yellow, clusters of galaxies grouped a great distance away, billions of light years away. And then finally, at the edge of perception, at the edge of our possibility to perceive, a carpet of little orange and red freckles. And those are galaxies that formed at the, within a few billion years of the Big Bang. So what we're seeing is what's lit up. We're seeing things that are lit, first of all. Most of the universe is made of some material that we conveniently call dark matter, which simply means we don't know what it is. We have no idea. That's most of the mass of the universe. So what we're seeing is something like the very, very top of the tip of an iceberg, and it's extremely beautiful and compelling. And it also happens to be, we believe, or at this stage of our evolution, we believe that's where we live. We live in, in a part of the universe that's brightly lit, and therefore our senses are equipped to understand it. But so much of the universe, and so much of even what is visible in these pictures, we just don't know. There's far more mystery in these images than there is certainty.
When Stan Gaz was a child, his family broke apart. His father had developed a drinking problem, so Stan's mother took him and his brother across the country to the East Coast. After a couple of years, they returned to California, and he was reintroduced to his father, who now had more of a grip on things.
I was 10 years old, and there was all these questions that needed to be answered in my own head. It was really important to me to connect with my father. Maybe I had all these fantasies of who he was, of what he was like, and maybe he didn't meet all of those expectations. But he certainly was an adventurous person. He drove an El Camino. He would let me ride in the back, even though I know that was against the law. But and we would, we would just drive out into the desert and go looking for rocks.
Stan's father was what you would call an amateur geologist, and he tried to pass his love for rocks onto his son on camping trips in the California desert.
He had graduated from geology, but he couldn't find a way to make money with it. So that was his passion and his love. But he then went back to school and became an optometrist. And I don't think he was so happy doing that, but he just couldn't find a way to make a living off of it. But, I mean, the way he talked about geology was with passion and with excitement. It always seemed like he was looking for a treasure, something that would be worth something. He liked to think that we would find some gold out, there someday or something, But of course, that never happened.
But one day, Stan found something special.
I just picked up a rock in the sand, in the dirt, and it just had this weird quality to it, this texture that didn't look like the other rocks, and it was pure black, and it was very heavy too.
It was a meteorite. A rock from outer space. Right away, Stan could see his dad was impressed with his find.
I could see it in his eyes that that he thought it was special. Whenever I found something interesting, I could see his eyes just flicker a little bit, And then I had to hold on to it tight because otherwise it would just disappear. But I had no interest in giving it to him. I felt like if I held on to it, he would kind of want to hold on to me a little bit, you know, more, or I would see him again, or something like that, you know.
So is that what you have in your hand?
Yeah, this is one of the rocks that we found, and I've kept everything that I didn't give to him or he didn't take, because he's not alive anymore. It's part of the memory, you know, of who he was.
So, fast forward a couple of decades. Stan is now a professional photographer. Accomplished, but not rich. He's searching for a new project. And he's got family problems of his own now. He's about to go through a divorce. So, he feels a bit adrift. And then, he comes across an advertisement for a rock show in Arizona. A show he once went to with his dad when he was young.
So, I decided to go out there and kind of retrace some of our footsteps, see if I remembered, you know, if it was the same or if it was different. And when I went out there, I was walking around and there were these meteorite dealers, and they had these postcards, and one of the postcards was of that crater in Arizona, in Flagstaff. And just, it was such a powerful image for me, and I'm incredibly visual, so it was so powerful that I needed to see it.
Now, the crater Stan is talking about is officially known as the Meteor Crater, but most locals still call it the Barringer Crater, in honor of Daniel Barringer, the mining engineer who spent most of his life and most of his fortune on proving to the world that his crater was made by a rock from outer space. When Stan saw the postcard image of the Barringer Crater at the Rock Fair in Tucson, he jumped in his rental car and drove straight there.
I was standing on the rim of the crater, and I started taking pictures right away. And I think for me, seeing it up close, it was a really good idea to go up there because it was so powerful. I guess you could just look at it as a hole in the ground, but it carries a lot of information, and that's why scientists study it or are learning to study them. You know, it's not all figured out. There's still a mystery to it, you know, to the crater. And I definitely wanted to capture something mysterious and beautiful. I did try and photograph it from the ground, but it was really difficult because of the landscape and the grade up to the hole, and it was very difficult. So I did what I could, but then I realized it was time to go home. And as I was driving back, it came to me, you know, I needed to photograph it from above. So I remembered this helicopter pilot that gave me his card in Tucson, and I gave him a call, and I asked him, I said, how hard would it be to do this? And he said, you know, he said, let's do it now. And sure enough, it must have been about an hour and a half later, here comes this helicopter, and he lands right there at the rest stop, and I jump in, and we go off. We flew right up to the crater, and I couldn't take my eyes off of the viewfinder, because once I did, you would realize it was real. Like, you were really 5,000 feet above the earth. And he was very willing to do some crazy stuff. I asked him, I said, can we fly into the crater? He said, do you want to fly into the crater? And I said, yes, I want to fly into the crater. And so he flew into the crater, and we flew in and around it. I can't even tell you, there was no door on the helicopter, and he would fly really high and then turn the helicopter on its side. And all I had is a seatbelt, a car seatbelt on, and all he could say was just don't fall out, you know, just hang on and don't fall out, or don't let your equipment fall out. And I would have to keep my eye on that viewfinder, on the viewfinder, looking through it and looking down at that hole. But it was just wonderful because it was this round, perfectly round hole, and I was using this square format camera. And it was just like compositionally, for an artist or like, you know, a painter, it's just such a center composition and so perfect. And you're just looking at it and you're thinking, this is going to be a beautiful photograph. And I knew right then that was my next project.
In 2009, Stan Gaz published a book called Sites of Impact. It collects all the pictures he took of meteor craters from all over the world.
Cassandra has an X-ray telescope. There's an X-ray telescope in the satellite. And we are in control of its flight, and also we download all of the images that it takes pictures of. We have a number of computer operators that download all the really strange pictures that are taken in outer space. I started working there about 2 months after they first launched the satellite. And I'm now the office manager there. I basically take care of a lot of really tedious things in the office that have absolutely nothing to do with what the scientists are looking at. What I do is really not fun at all. It's just a huge headache that absorbs most of my day and really leaves nothing left for me to think about. When I want to sit down and think about what I really care about, which is art, I just can't. I'm completely void, and I just stare into space, and I feel like there's nothing left in me, and I feel like a robot. Satellite Cassandra was launched with the understanding that it was looking for something that was fairly top secret, and to be honest, I don't really know what it is. I can't even go into the room where the computer operators are downloading these images every day. So if I need to speak to any of them, I need to request that they step out of their office and talk to me or come into my office. The reason that I'm allowed to actually have access to the images that we print out is because we have 7 printers. And as is typical, I guess, within government offices, these printers break down constantly. And because I'm the office manager, I'm in charge of maintenance contracts. We only have one person that we can get to service this machine. He's got the proper security clearance, and he happens to be about, I don't know, 80 years old, and his name is Jackson, and he is the most decrepit old man I have ever met. He is obsessed with the fact that I wear my hair in ponytails, and he wants to cut them off. He used to be a hairdresser. I tell him that I wear my hair in ponytails because I'm trying to let it grow out, and I don't want to deal with it. And he tells me on a regular basis that the best way to let your hair grow out is to have lots and lots of sex, and that he would be ready and willing to provide this for me at any point should I need it. And so I have to deal with this every time one of our 7 printers, which are named after the 7 dwarfs, breaks down. So I see Jackson a lot. I can't really say that it's all bad at the Operations Control Center, because Since I'm a university employee, I can take classes, and they're free. So I'm taking this website design class, and it's so great. I mean, I really think I can do something with this. I don't know. I mean, at these classes, I go Tuesdays and Thursday nights, and it's just a crash course in HTML and Flash. They really try to focus on the HTML so that you really understand the fundamentals of building a web page. I just can't tell you how much this has changed my life. I mean, I really, really am focused on this. I think that in a year or maybe in 6 months, I could just really say I was a web designer. There is a positive aspect to all of this. What's weird about this is that Cassandra is also the name of the song that this band named Jasmine wrote. About 4 years ago, I went on a trip to New York City over the weekend. We went to the Knitting Factory to see these bands play, and Jasmine was a headlining band. And I had a backstage pass because I was with one of the bands that was playing. I didn't actually stay to watch that band. I was outside having a fight with somebody, and I was really upset, and I spent most of my evening outside just sort of thinking about the fight that I just had and just really not being present emotionally. And I finally decided to go back inside into the club, and I just sat down at the back of the club, and I just sort of closed my eyes and let the music take over. And I realized the music was just incredibly beautiful. It completely changed my mood. I was just so happy and so peaceful. And I went backstage, and I felt like I could deal with the person that I was fighting with then, and I went to wait with the band that I had arrived with. And I accidentally bumped into the band that had just performed, the one that had just really calmed me down, and that was the band Jasmine. And I looked right at the lead guitarist, and he looked at me, and we both were just stunned. We both froze. And I felt like I couldn't speak, and I didn't know why I was freezing in front of him. And I just knew. I knew him. That just sounds so stupid, but I know. I knew then that I'd known him before, and that somehow we were connected to each other. And I was just shaking and frozen at the same time. And I don't know how I managed to say anything to him, but I think I just told him that I think I thanked him for his performance. And that was Max. I sent the band some of my artwork, and I just wrote to them saying that their music translates everything I've ever tried to do in my paintings and in my printmaking and in my drawings. And I'm just so happy to have found something out there that seems to understand what I'm trying to do in my artwork. And Max wrote back to me, and we started writing to each other, and we developed this really strange friendship. I was having dreams about him, where I was going to places that I've never been to, and I was with him, and I was visiting certain people. And I was confused in my dreams. I would say things like, why are we going here? I don't understand why we're going here. And he would say something like, because we're visiting so-and-so. And then I would tell Max that I had this dream, and he would tell me something to the effect of, well, I had just been to that place, and I was visiting this person. So basically, I was pretty much following him around in my dreams. And it just really confused me. So then things progress, and now we're emailing on a daily basis, and it's very intense. And he finally asked me to come see him. I booked a flight to Albuquerque, and I went out to see him. I was just really nervous on the plane. All I could do was think about him and what I was going to say to him, and, you know, how things were going to go for the whole week. And I was, you know, I just remember shaking as I got off the plane. I went to the bathroom to try and calm down, and then I, you know, went outside to meet him, and he was just standing there with his hands in his pockets, and he had just this foul look on his face, and I was floored. I mean, I don't understand, because, you know, a couple days ago he was emailing me, flirting with me, He just seemed completely overjoyed that I was coming to see him. And I just felt so sure this was going to be a good trip and, you know, finally sort of make everything congeal a little bit, you know, make it seem more real at least. And Terry was just being blank and empty towards me. We get in the car and we start driving, and he's just asking me if I'm hungry. Do I need something to eat? And so I just sort of say yes, and then we grab some cheap Thai food and eat in silence. Finally, he says to me that his ex-girlfriend called him yesterday and flew into Albuquerque, and that he was still in love with her, and he needs to go talk to her tomorrow, the next day. He pretty much spent the whole week with her. I had to spend the whole week with his housemates. When he drove me back to the airport at the end of the week, we didn't speak in the car, and he didn't even help me with my luggage. He didn't even help me get it out of the car, and he didn't even get out of the car at all. I had to get out, and he just waved goodbye. I was crying the whole time on the plane. I was crying the whole time, and I didn't even care. I didn't even care who was watching me cry. You know, I didn't understand why. I didn't know what I did wrong. I didn't know what went wrong, really. I mean, I felt like I had no control over what had happened. It just wasn't fair that she came back, and it wasn't fair the way he treated me. And so I didn't know what anything meant anymore. I mean, I believed so much in that whole relationship. I just believed so much in, like, this connection. And why did I even meet him? What was the point of that? Why did I feel that way when I saw him? But the more I thought about it, the more I thought about that moment. And I guess I just started remembering that more than what had just happened. And I don't know, by the time I got back to Boston, I'd kind of changed everything around in my head, and I kind of felt like, you know, I bet that's not the end of it. I bet that there's more to this, and we're not done yet. That's why I can't really leave this job, you know, because, well, the email address he has is at the Cassandra Project. And I just want to make sure that he can get in touch with me at whatever point this is going to happen, because I know he's going to get in touch with me.
So how long ago was this since the trip?
Well, it's been about 2 years.
So you haven't heard from him for 2 years, but you're certain that he's going to get in touch with you?
Yes, I'm certain. One of the printers on our floor, the one that's closest to my office, started basically freaking out. All of our printers, all 7 of them, are hooked up to the computers that download the images from the satellite. But one of the data operators came up to me and told me that the images that were being generated were not being prompted by anybody in the office. This is really a cause for alarm because of all the security that we have going on here. That's just not supposed to happen. So I went to see what was going on, and the first thing I thought of is that, oh, the printer's just being weird and we need to get it fixed. And as much as I didn't want to see my friend Jackson again, I decided on my own to call him in. I didn't wait for anybody to tell me to do that. And I let him up, and we started just trying to take apart the printer, and we couldn't take it apart. I tried to open it, and then Jackson kind of pushed me aside, and he said, no, let me do it, honey. And so he's like he's basically just putting all of his might into it. He's really just yanking on the thing. He's thrusting his entire body back, and his face is turning red, and he just can't get it undone. And then he started shaking. And I'm looking at him like, oh my God, what's going on? So I don't know what to do, so I call the paramedics. Basically what happened, he was having a heart attack, and I'm assuming that's what he was having, a heart attack. I've never seen a heart attack before. So I bring the paramedics up and I bring them over to him, and by the time we get to him, he's dead. They put him on the gurney and they take him out of there. In the meantime, chaos is ensuing. I mean, everybody's freaking out about this printer. I don't even really know what's going on. I mean, now at this point, the printer, Happy, is being closely guarded. Every image that is being cranked out of there is being snatched up and being delivered to a group of scientists in a room, and they're sort of having conferences over these pictures. I wasn't able to get out of there until about 9:30 that night. And when I came in the next day, they were all still there. They had never left. And now the entire office was cluttered with mailing tubes. Overnight, they had sealed these posters into mailing tubes. I mean, there must have been about 300 at least that I was supposed to address and send out to specialists all over the world. So I spent all day typing up and slapping on addresses to these tubes all day. I was there 12 and a half hours, and all I did was slap mailing labels on tubes. But before I left, I broke open one of those tubes, and I took out the poster, and I folded it up really small, and I stuck it into this pocket that's in the inside of my courier pack. And I flattened it out, and I walked out. When I got home, I was exhausted. So I just unpacked my bag and took the poster out of the bag. And I tacked it up on my kitchen wall. I didn't even really look at it. I just went to bed. That night, I just had the most intense, incredible dream about Mac. It was just an incredibly intense dream. It was like a whole other life. It was amazing. We were married. I was pregnant with this child. I was going to have a job as a web designer. I had that all set up after I had the child. And Max's band was doing amazing. He just got signed to a really big record label. We had this incredible house. We had a studio set up in the basement for him to do all of his recording and production work. And his band could just practice there as well. And then on the second floor was a studio for me where I could do my painting and linoleum prints. I had beautiful long hair. The dream, it just seemed like it wasn't just one day. It was just like a whole life. It was every beautiful aspect of what our life is, what it's going to be. And then the alarm clock went off, and I woke up. I sat up, and that dream just dissolved. And this made me just made me so sad, and I just started crying. And I was like, oh, I can't go to work today. I can't do it. So I called one of the numbers. Nobody picked up the phone, of course. So I just left a message. I just told him I was sick and I wasn't coming in. I went to the kitchen and I started to make some breakfast. But I was just so sad. I couldn't even do that, you know. And I was just basically sitting in the kitchen crying. I got up to get a drink of water. And then I stepped on a tack. And it went all the way into my foot, and I screamed, and I sat back down, and I was trying to get it out, and it was so painful. It struck a nerve, and I was just rocking back and forth, screaming and crying. And blood was just getting everywhere, all over my robe, all over the carpet. And then I heard this voice, and it's saying really softly, "Kara, Kara, don't cry." So I look up and I look around and I realize the voice is coming from the poster. The poster has become more like a window in my wall, a window to outer space. And there's a strange amorphous thing in outer space, and it almost looks like an organ that's vibrating, or like a heart or something. And that's what is talking to me. It says again to me, it says, "Kara, don't cry. I love you." And I just sit there, and I can't, and my mouth is like on the floor. And all I can think of is that this is some sort of divine being talking to me. And then he says to me, "My dreams of Max were actually visions of the future. And he told me that I had done right to stay at my job, and that I was going to soon get an email from Max. And in this email, Max would tell me how much he missed me and how much he needed me and how important it was that we get back together." After this, the window turned back into a picture. And I stopped crying, and I got myself together and made some breakfast. I did go to work the next day, but there wasn't an email from Max. There hasn't been one yet, but I know there will be one soon, probably very soon. I mean, everything's changed now. For example, I don't say I'm going to be a web designer anymore. I say I am a web designer.
I recorded these conversations with Kara Tutungian almost 10 years ago, back in the early days of web design. I wrote and asked her if there was an update. Did Max show up? Was she still waiting around? Any more from the space poster? But I didn't get a reply. My email bounced back.
People have been seeing UFOs or, you know, mysterious objects in the skies and talking about them and writing about them since people started looking up. Certain ideas just have incredible potency and currency, and I think the UFO is one of those.
One of the most potent ideas about UFOs is that the government is keeping information about flying saucers and ETs from the people. But Mark Pilkington, in his new book Mirage Men, makes the case that there's nothing further from the truth. The government, he says, has been feeding fake documents about UFOs and seeding disinformation to the UFO faithful since the beginning.
The modern sort of UFO era really begins in June 1947 with the now legendary sighting of nine glowing objects skimming through the air like horses on water, seen by Kenneth Arnold, who was a fire extinguisher salesman, a kind of private salesman, flying his own aircraft around Mount Rainier in Washington State. Arnold actually didn't think these were from outer space at all. He thought they were experimental aircraft, probably Soviet or American. And what happened was, when he sort of told the press and about his sighting, and it was actually a journalist called Bill Beckett who coined the term flying saucers based on what Arnold had told him, and there sort of began a craze. I think as he sort of spoke to more and more newspapers and and radio stations and interviewers, he began to talk about the idea that these were atomic-powered experimental American aircraft, and this would have drawn the attention of the Air Force and perhaps the FBI, because little did he know that the Air Force actually were trying to develop a nuclear propulsion system for aircraft, which very few people knew about. So to have him talking about this through all and sundry via the media was unacceptable.
Now, some of the earliest government documents you unearth link UFO belief with subversion.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think, and you can imagine that was an extreme but understandable viewpoint for some people within the offices of the Pentagon, for example, because you're taking an interest in things that you shouldn't be taking interest in, and you're also you're sort of open to manipulation by unfriendly nations. And it's interesting that back in the early 50s, you know, the thing that was, which organizations like the Psychological Strategy Board, who sort of tried to control how Americans not only thought, but how they were perceived by others, you know, what the thing they were most concerned about is that communist ideas and ideals were presented as in any way attractive. And actually, you found a few of the, quite a few of the, or certainly some of the early people who made contact with alleged extraterrestrials were actually sort of quite in favor of communism. And this was just another example of how dangerous, you know, UFO belief could be. So I think very early on, the government or various departments within the government and the military would have sat up and taken notice.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to take the government very long to come up with a plan to use these commie UFO spotters. In the early 1950s, something goes down in Washington, D.C. that you write about. UFOs fly over the White House. Or do they?
Yeah, this was in late July 1952 when unidentified objects appeared on radar screens at Washington National Airport, and interceptors were sent out to pursue them and identify them, which they failed to do. I suspect of piecing together various bits of corroborative information and evidence that this was a demonstration or a test of a technology that would later on, sort of by the late 50s, be known as palladium and would be used regularly and frequently, and I would imagine is still used today in some form by the NSA, the National Security Agency, and the CIA. So a number of different military and intelligence groups have deployed the UFO story as a cover for their covert operations over the years. It's just one of the many sort of toys that can be pulled out of the dressing up box.
You show how the Air Force and the NSA and the CIA have used this UFO story to mask secret projects time and time again, but you also believe that the UFO story has been used to cover up government tests on the nation's hamburger supply.
That's one of my sort of wilder assertions, I'd say. But there have been since the late 60s and through the 70s, and it still continues today, these things that people have sort of termed cattle mutilations, which are apparently bizarre and non-accidental deaths of ranch cattle. And certainly in some areas, one possibility is that they follow epidemiological sort of research patterns, so they're actually looking at cows in the natural environment to assess the spread of either possibly radiation or even the spread of prions that lead to Creutzfeldt's Jakob's disease in humans. And actually there's some sort of reasonable sort of corroborative evidence for this. For example, the things that are often reported missing are sex organs and the tongue and the anus and the sort of soft tissues, mucus-rich tissues where things pass in and out of the organism of the cow. And actually, I spoke to a friend here who worked for the UK Food Standards Agency, and as soon as I described that, he just immediately said, well, that's what you'd look for. Those are the parts you'd take if you were looking for contamination or the spread of, you know, of toxins. So that's interesting. And something that was a coup for me, I think, and actually nobody's really picked up on in the so far from reading the book, is the reference to the Hughes 500 penetrator, the quiet one, which is the fabled silent helicopter developed for use by the CIA in at the beginning of the 1970s, and they were used on two missions in Vietnam, then flown back to California, and nobody heard of them again. So there may be all manner of incidents that have gone down in the UFO lore that might actually sort of have some connection to these silent helicopters.
Hmm. In your research, you meet a lot of these purported government agents responsible for the deception and the disinformation. You call them Mirage Men. One agent, Richard Doty, seems to have a special hold on you.
Yeah, Richard Doty, or Rick, as we knew him. I mean, he was he's something of a sort of legend, sort of quite infamous in UFO culture for being the only guy and to ever really be exposed as running disinformation operations with the UFO community, and he was doing this back in the late 70s and early 1980s, based in Kirtland Air Force Base. And the program, the project that Rick was involved in, became incredibly important and influential, and had a devastating effect on the UFO community in the late 1980s, and the impact is still felt to this day, and involved targeting an engineer, a very, very brilliant man called Paul Benowitz, who, for whatever reason, seemed to be a believer in ET visitation, and he saw and filmed strange lights flying at night, so very early in the morning, over Kirtland Air Force Base, and began filming these and reporting the sightings to the security people at Kirtland. And he was doing this thinking, I need to tell people that there are strange lights, tell the people at Kirtland they've got strange lights flying over their base, and they should know about this. Now, what's really interesting, in the past, people have assumed that he saw test flights of some kind of experimental craft that he shouldn't have seen. But what doesn't make any sense is they decided to feed him increasingly lurid and outrageous stories about UFO invasions and evil, sort of deadly aliens living in an underground base at a town called Delphi, New Mexico, a few hours away from Albuquerque, and they've discontinued for several years, to the extent that very sadly drove Paul Benowitz completely over the edge, to the point where he was sandbagging himself into his house, and he had a wife and children. He became convinced that they were extraterrestrials in human form trying to kill him. His family ended up in the late 80s, actually putting him into a mental hospital. And what to me is fascinating is to see how these stories that he was sort of helping to propagate and generate and research ended up being kind of key elements of the popular UFO lore. So by, you know, the mid-1990s, you could see them in The X-Files and in Independence Day, and, you know, then they'd all, you know, the feedback loop just grows in size and enormity.
Uh-huh. Well, you make clear Rick Doty's role in the operation, but he seems more incompetent dude than mastermind. What's not clear is who was in charge or why they wanted to drive this guy insane in the first place.
I mean, my take on it is that the purpose of the Benowitz campaign was to just sow so much information, so much chaff and distortion and disorientation into the UFO community that it basically disintegrated. And that's effectively what happened. They did a very good job, and they're still, 30 years later, still arguing over some of the documents that were seeded into the community at this time.
But, you know, UFO believers are not the only folks who want to hold on to their beliefs, no matter what evidence you show them. But you seem to have met a lot of individuals who can admit that what they used to believe in was fake, but that this only proves to them that there really are UFOs and aliens out there.
Yeah,
is this just fanatic belief at work, or are the Mirage Men still at it?
Yes, I think both. I mean, I think what you've hit on there is exactly the point, that there's a sort of strange, cognitive processing glitch that we have, or a sort of emotional processing glitch that we have that was explored in the early 50s by sociologists, particularly a guy called Leon Festinger, who developed a term called cognitive dissonance. And this is something you see often when dealing with deeply held unusual beliefs. And this is what happens is that if you hold extreme beliefs, so that UFOs are extraterrestrial spacecraft and the reality of this fact is being withheld from the American people by the government, if someone is able to counter that belief by, say, demonstrating that the documents you thought were evidence for it were actually disinformation, then rather than going away and saying, oh, well, I guess I have to, you know, I'll find something else to believe in, or, well, I'm glad I haven't wasted any more time believing that, or, you know, writing about that or protesting that. Instead, people become even more deeply entrenched in the beliefs that they held, and this is something you see again and again.
But do you think the Mirage Men are still working the UFO community? You know, kind of pushing that there's another layer to the story?
That's the sort of $50 billion question. And this person we spoke to, who'd most recently been involved in these kinds of operations, was working in 1999, and I have no reason to see why they'd have stopped doing it, you know, since then. The UFO arena, it just, for all sorts of reasons, just makes an excellent place to see how people with unusual beliefs and extreme beliefs operate. And it's also, of course, a very useful place for unfriendly agents to go poking around trying to make sense of sniff out new technologies and new aircraft that are being developed, because that's what UFO people are doing. They're looking up at the skies, looking out for unusual objects.
This episode of Too Much Information is called Far Away, So Close. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Bill Bowen. And it featured Michael Benson, Stan Gaz, Kara Tutungian, and Mark Pilkington. On the TMI show page, you'll find pictures, links, and audio archives. And you can subscribe to the TMI podcast. All that at WFMU.org.
Thank you.